Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, February 9th, 2025, is by the Reverend Barbara Threat on the topic of How Do I Love Thee?
In 1845, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, in her well-known poem, asked, "How do I love thee?" Her slightly abbreviated answer to her own question, "I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely. I love thee purely and with passion. I love thee with the breath and smiles and tears of all my life." And in 1960, Etta James recorded, "At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over. And life is filled with song. At last, the sky is above our blue. My heart was wrapped in clover the night I looked at you. I found a dream I could call my own, a thrill I've never known. You smiled, and the spell is cast. And here we are in heaven, for you are mine at last." Sometime in the early 1300s, Chinese poet Guan Duosheng wrote, "You and I have so much love that it burns like a fire, in which we bake a lump of clay, molded into a figure, a single figure, of you and me." The Beatles proclaimed that all you need is love, and the Bible says the greatest of these is love, and a friend loveth at all times, and the list goes on and on and on. Love is an amazing thing, a many-splendored thing, actually, filling our hearts with song and hope and joy. And being in love is, well, blissful. And I truly hope that all of us have had experiences in our life when we're feeling all that stuff. It is among the best experiences in life. Love, we are assured, is what makes the world go round. One could wonder, then, why there's a divorce rate of almost 50%. Perhaps part of the reason for that statistic is because we expect so much of love. We want violins sweetly playing and lovers running toward one another through grassy, wildflower-decked fields, which have no mosquitoes and no prickles, of course. We want romantic meals and roses enjoyed with a soul partner who shares our interest and anticipates our every need and supports our every whim. Love makes us complete, which implies that once we've found our love, there is no more turmoil or trouble. Whatever happens, we'll face it together. And we'll always have each other to rely on. It does sound blissful, but life is not that way. In fact, it's not even close. So if love is so great, why is it often so difficult? Well, there are lots of reasons, of course, but one of them is our differing understandings of what it means to be in love and how we give and receive love, what shows love and what doesn't. I think of my parents' marriage. It was an average marriage, I would say, for those marrying in the late 1940s. It wasn't a great love story, and it wasn't a disaster. They married, they had four kids, they bought a house, a few houses, they raised a family, and they grew old together. He loved trains, both his extensive model train setup and actual trains, and he often went on train trips, and my mother was welcome to go with him, but if she didn't, he'd still go. He really enjoyed a good classical music concert or the summer opera at Glimmerglass. Again, my mother could join him, but if she didn't, he'd still go himself. Dad read widely. And while he had a social side, mostly with fellow train lovers, he was basically an introvert, quite comfortable in his woodshop, listening to classical music while working on some project. He was the church treasurer for years, probably for decades, but he rarely talked about religion outside of church. I always had a feeling that his involvement in the church was more of a habit or a placation to my mother than any kind of a theological statement. My mother took pride in her housekeeping skills, and she loved to sew, usually while listening to a Christian radio station. She had numerous flower beds, but her big passion was the town where she had been born and grown up. She kept in touch with a wide array of people from that town, and it was the center of her world. She corresponded with relatives from Sweden and Finland, where her parents had come from. She cherished her roots. And she loved to talk. My father called her chatty. She was deeply involved in her church and she was passionate about winning souls for Jesus. She kept trying with mine and it never quite worked. But the church was the anchor of her religious faith as well as the center of her social life. She taught Bible classes at a local Christian elementary school and she volunteered several weeks, hours a week in a local hospital. And she loved to be around people, especially if they shared her take on religion or if they had any interest in that silly little town. They were two quite different people, which is not unusual in a marriage. For the most part, they encouraged one another's interests, even though they didn't participate much in each other's lives. When Dad died, they had just celebrated their 55th anniversary. Most people would have said that theirs was a happy marriage, but it was more complicated, at least from my mother's viewpoint. And that was because of my father's sister, Esther, and her marriage to John. John and Esther had known each other since first grade. They were playmates as young children and then best friends. And then shortly after high school, it turned into a romance. This was all in a tiny little town. John and Esther shared a passion for bird watching. They both enjoyed camping and canoeing, and they loved the same music. They took dancing lessons together. They played music together. When they traveled, it was together on a camping trip that emphasized bird watching and canoes. John had his own business and Esther kept the books, so they spent almost all of every day together. John was the local fire chief. John actually died a month and a half or 2 months ago at the age of 100. He had turned 100 the day before. Esther headed up the firemen's auxiliary. Esther died actually a few years before John, just after their 75th wedding anniversary, and John was holding her when she died. My mother would occasionally mention how wonderful it must be for Aunt Esther to share so many things with her husband, to talk everything through together, to be so deeply connected. What a gift it must be to be married to your best friend. My mother did try. She'd ask my father how work went, and he'd reply, "It's fine," and go back to reading the paper. She'd go on about her day, of course, and he would murmur occasionally. She would invite him to help in her garden, and he'd pull weeds for a few rows and then drift back to the wood shop. Her ideal of love meant sharing interests and spending lots of quality time together, deep conversations, lots of shared interests. Dad wasn't much of a sharer, and he was happy spending time alone. Since she kept comparing her marriage to Esther's, she would sometimes get pretty frustrated. She kept trying to make him her best friend, and it never worked. And how did Dad show his love? He did things for her. In the spring, a flat of pansies and a new set of pruning shears would appear, or a bracelet that he thought she'd like would arrive in the mail. He often brought her little gifts, little stuffed animals, odd little things. He was rather like one of those male birds, a raven or a blue jay, that brings presents to the female. One summer, she went to Sweden to visit family. She'd asked Dad to go, but he had no interest, although he was happy she could go. But while she was gone, he completely remodeled the kitchen for her. He'd actually been making new cabinets out in the shop for weeks, knowing that she would almost never come in. He would frequently take her out to dinner on the spur of the moment just to give her a break, he'd say. His way of showing love was to do things that he believed would make her life more pleasant. She'd rarely do anything just for his pleasure. It wasn't how she'd thought. She'd try to engage him in a conversation. She wanted him to talk and be a best friend. He wanted to be helpful and bring presents. I've often suspected that had they married in recent years, they'd eventually have decided they'd grown apart and they would have gone their separate ways. Instead, they stayed married, reasonably contented and mostly in parallel. There are many ways to show love. And perhaps one of the reasons our experience of love is so often so far from the idyllic depiction in literature and song is because it's hard to recognize and appreciate the ways of showing love that are different from what comes naturally to us. Marriage counselor Dr. Gary Chapman, in his book, The Five Love Languages, suggests that one of the challenges in any relationship, marriage, family, friendship, even colleagues, perhaps even in church communities, is when two people speak a different love language. Love encompasses so many kinds of relationships and so many different kinds of love. In his terms, my mother's love language was quality time, doing things together, even being best friends. My father's language was a combination of acts of service for her, doing things he thought she'd appreciate, and giving gifts, which were almost always things that she really did like. It was clear that he observed carefully. But quality time and acts of service and gift giving are three quite valid and quite different ways of demonstrating love. And if you really want one and get the other, it can be confusing. There are other ways of showing love too, of course. Physical affection is certainly one of them. And physical affection encompasses a lot more than sex. For infants and children, physical affection is the most important demonstration of love. A baby learns its love by being held and played with, by being fed and changed and cuddled, so its physical needs are met. And for many of us, the drive for physical affection continues to be important. Sometimes that gets more complicated as we get older. Even as adults, some of us are naturally huggers. Some of us will quickly hug almost any of us. And others rarely demonstrate affection physically, and that doesn't mean that they don't care. There are cultural variations, of course, and all sorts of boundary issues, as we see when some public figure, usually an older male, claims that he was just being affectionate with a subordinate, which is usually a much younger female. Acceptable expressions of physical affection change over time. I can recall many brief but supportive hugs from teachers, male and female, when I was in school over half a century ago, and those are much, much less common now. In many schools, they're simply not allowed. And as a minister, I know that I'm careful about who I hug and why and where and especially in what setting. But still, we know that physical contact shows our care for another person, at least in our society. And it's interesting to live to move in other societies where touch is so much different, lots more or lots less. When we pat someone on the arm to encourage them, or greet a friend with a handshake, do a high five to celebrate or take the hand of someone who is grieving, we're using physical contact to recognize and affirm our connection. Physical affection is probably the demonstration of love that most quickly comes to mind, but it isn't what everybody automatically goes to. Words of affirmation matter too. A teenager is often resistant to physical affection from a parent, oh my God, and sincere words of encouragement or admiration are usually welcome. Compliments often elicit smiles, whether it's a compliment from a partner or one from someone at a checkout counter. In our own congregation, the words that we say to thank someone for setting up tables or managing the sound, thank you, Bruce, singing a song or telling a story or arranging an event, those are part of the glue that keeps us together. As our society gets more circumspect about hugs, the words of support or affirmation that teachers or doctors or bosses or coworkers or even fellow church members give to one another become even more important. And quality time does matter, I would say, to most of us. Good friends may rarely express their affection verbally, and they may not be physically affectionate, but they often seek out one another's company. They enjoy spending time together, and they share enough interests and values and opinions so that it's usually pleasant to be together. It may even be more pleasant to be together than it is to be apart. In our church and others, that's one of the reasons that we gather every Sunday and at other times as well. It's one of the reasons that we're all here this morning. We simply enjoy one another's company. We find meaning and comfort and joy in being together. It is pleasurable to sing together, to eat together, to work on a social justice project together, to just sit and chat and see where the conversation goes. We don't actually spend a lot of time together quantitatively, maybe a few hours a week, sometimes only one. But the quality of the time when we're together matters a lot to each of us. It's what brought us here this morning, even though we're only small boxes on a Zoom screen. It is good to be together. And acts of service matter to one another as well. When a parent who is already tired agrees to drive a child to a friend's house, That child is receiving an act of service, something the parent didn't have to do, may even have preferred not to do, but did anyway out of love for a child. That happens in our churches too. We sign up for something that maybe isn't enthusing, but we know that it needs doing and that we can do it. When we gather to clean our building or set up a table for some community event, it's an act of service for our church community, done out of caring for each other, and maybe for the larger community as well. We each probably have other things we could do instead of greeting visitors on Sunday or staffing a table at a community event, but we choose to give service out of love. When you run an errand for your parents so that they won't need to, it's another way of showing your love. Much of our social justice work is a form of service in the larger world, even to people that we don't know. We do this work out of a general regard for others, simply to make their love easier. And then there's giving and receiving gifts, my father's bowerbird behavior. That gets a little more complicated sometimes. There are certainly occasions when we give a gift out of obligation, even give gifts to people we don't much like at all. But giving gifts can also be an important indication of love. And those gifts don't need to be big. A friend says that the regular weekly phone call from her daughter in Seattle is the best gift she can imagine. Often gifts are practical and still given freely, although the giver could have chosen not to give. Over two-thirds of all young adults under 25 still receive at least some financial help from their parents. And almost a third of those who are between 30 and 35 still receive such assistance. Probably some of those gifts are out of sheer necessity and don't really feel like a gift at all. And some of them are probably to maintain control. But many of them are probably given out of love, out of the desire to be helpful, to make life easier. Most of us are willing to give our time and attention and even our money to people and causes that we love, that we value. As is the case with acts of service, many of us choose to give gifts to those we may never know, donating money to organizations that do work that we believe in, bringing clothes to distribute to the community cafe, or donating to organizations whose work is halfway around the world. And such acts may become even more important in the coming months. And of course, that giving as an expression of love is true in our church too. I won't dwell on this, but just to put a tiny bug in your ear, when you fill out your pledge card in a month or two or three, whatever money you pledge is a gift to our community, given out of love and appreciation for what this community means to you. The time donated to set for a service or bring a dish to a potluck, all of those are gifts of love, reminding each other of how much we care for one another. One of the challenges in life, the one that kept tripping my mother up when she compared her marriage to her sister-in-law's, is when we overlook the ways that someone else is trying to show us that they care about us, while wishing that they would do it the way that we prefer. In the meantime, the other person may well be wondering why we don't respond with the appreciation that their gestures certainly deserve, and why we can't show them a little bit of love in return. I happen to know that my aunt occasionally expressed being quite envious of my mother. My uncle almost never brought her little unexpected presents, she said, since they were usually together. She, who had plenty of quality time, said she would have appreciated a bit of my dad's slightly detached but attentive and unexpected gift-giving. When it comes to human relationships, it's often as if two people are speaking different languages. Because in many ways, they really are. Our histories and our personalities, our education and health and goals, those are different for each of us. And so the ways we express our love and affection and caring will be different too. And how we interpret what the other person does will be different. It is, in fact, very confusing. Fortunately, it's possible to learn to translate, to assess each other's habits more generously. It's part of accepting our differences, even our peculiarities. The person you know who approaches the holiday season by quickly buying a gift card from the same place for everyone on their list probably isn't one who expresses affection through carefully thought-out presents. It's likely that when you give them a gift that took you hours to find, took much, much time and thought, they may not even recognize that it's an expression of how much you care for them. And they're very unlikely to realize how much you wish that they had put a little time into their gift instead of just one more gift card. Sometimes it's helpful to explain, and it may be hard because the other person really doesn't get what you're talking about. Gift giving as a thoughtful act, for example, isn't part of the love language of the other person's vocabulary. You may be able to explain why a carefully chosen gift means so much to you and why it means so much to give it to them, and they may hear, but it's not likely actually that they'll remember. That's not their fallback position. One of the challenges, maybe one of the adventures of relationships, is figuring out how what love and connection means to another person and learning how to speak in their language, at least occasionally. One of my daughters, I've learned over the years, loves to spend quality time with those she cares about. A walk, a dinner, a long chat, a shared project, a sincere compliment, those are how she shows love and receives love. But unless you're a close friend or one of her kids, don't even try a casual hug. That is not her language. For the other daughter, it's acts of service, ways of helping her out. An offer to weed her garden, whether she's there or not, running an errand or planning a shared outing, those work for her. When someone has her back and makes her life easier, she feels loved, and she's good at showing that kind of love to others. And hugs, lots of hugs. You can touch her arm to make a point when you're talking or offer a hand to help her up, give her a swaddle to cuddle in. Physical affection matters. But words of affirmation, not so much. Telling her how much you appreciate something doesn't make much difference. It's actions that count. They're very different people, and the things that they interpret as meaning, I care about you, or even I love you, are very different. And the things that they offer to those they love are very different. So in this month of love and Valentine's, consider what sorts of things make you feel loved and cared for, and how you're most likely to demonstrate your care and affection for others. And then look closely at those who matter most to you. What makes them feel cared for? And what may not be what you most easily offer? How do they show you that they care for you? And that may not be what you wish you got. You may be surprised at what you discover. Or perhaps, to the delight of those you care about most, you may have already figured out what they offer and how you can respond most gratefully. It is a complicated thing to love anyone beloved, whether it's in the most intimate relationships or with friendships, fellow congregants, working partners. It's a complicated thing, this caring for one another and being cared for. My hope for all of us is that we're fortunate enough to have someone we care for deeply who cares for us and who lets us know, and that we're wise enough to recognize how we're loved, and that we're each generous enough to show our love in ways that others will recognize too. So happy Valentine's Day week. The world right now needs all the love it can get, shown through compassion and companionship and so many other ways, to each other and to those we will never know. May each of us have lots of love.